Welcome back to the Conservative Cat Show. I so do appreciate you being here. Go ahead, hit that subscribe button if you're just joining us. We've got lots to get to this morning, and I'm going to jump right in. But if you want to support the program, there's always a way to do it. You can send super chats. I will take your chats here probably within 15 minutes, probably around 6:30 a.m. You can also visit patriotpumpenergy.com, get your bottle of premium pre-workout. It's on the shelf behind me here. We have the fruit punch flavor. It is a premium pre-workout, a great energy drink alternative, not gobs of like caffeine and sugar in it. We're not trying to get you addicted. We're trying to provide you long-lasting energy, and that's patriotpumpenergy.com. Use promo code conservativecat for $10 off at checkout. That's the best promo code out there. We give it to you, the listener, the viewer. I am so appreciative. Happy Monday morning at 6:16 a.m. Good morning. Hey, John, how you doing? We are going to be jumping right into this mass murderer. And I'm going to be honest with you. I'm kind of a news hound, and I did not see this story. And I feel really bad for not sharing it with you, because you need to know that there is this killer, alleged killer. He is answering for his alleged crimes now, but I mean, he, not before there was 18 people murdered. Okay, so 18 people have been allegedly murdered by this fellow, the mass murderer you might not have ever heard of. We're going to be talking about him here on Conservative Cat. The corrupt media will not talk about this guy, and throw into the comment section why you think that is. Why is it the corrupt media is not talking about a guy who killed 18 people? This is in all of, I think this is in Arkansas history. I mean, there are Alabama, sorry, excuse me, Alabama, Birmingham, Alabama. This is the most insane serial killer. I mean, deadliest accused killer in Alabama history, and the mainstream media won't talk about it. So we're going to get to that. Plus, Supreme Court Justice Amy Coney Barrett. I'm not a big fan of her. She does have this new book out, and she's defending the Dobbs decision. And she is telling us that we need to tune out critics like Hillary Clinton. So I think that that's interesting. There's also a few interesting things that Amy Coney Barrett has to say in this new book. So I will be unpacking some of her comments on the show. And then I also want to talk about Illinois and how they're spending billions on higher education for empty classrooms, essentially, because students are fleeing the state. Higher ed students are fleeing the state. They're choosing places like Indiana, Ohio, Iowa to go to school. But yet we're spending more than we ever have on higher education. So we're going to get to all of it. Plus, 95% of Americans agree on this. You can't get 95% of Americans to agree on anything anymore. We're a very divided nation, but we agree that we should end congressional insider trading now. And I find it interesting that the Democrats have created their own little bill here to address insider trading, and it doesn't have any teeth. There's already something out there. Josh Hawley introduced it, the Pelosi Act. They haven't moved on that. So this is just more lip service, I think. It's pretending. The Democrats have introduced at a federal level something to combat insider trading, a bill, legislation to combat insider trading. And I just don't think that it's really anything except lip service. So I'm going to dig into it. Smash that like button. Share this out with your friends. Yes, I am back in my studio. Yes, I traveled from South Carolina back to Illinois. A beautiful state. I love South Carolina. I love the South. It's incredible. Like, as soon as you get down south, people are so much nicer. The billboards all talk about Jesus. Like, people love their Jesus down there. And it was very refreshing to be in the free state of South Carolina. But I am back in Illinois now. Is he an illegal alien? Is he black? Is he trans? Yes, he's actually black. And I hate to say it, but I think that is why the mainstream media will not touch this with a 30-foot pole. So let's talk about this. I actually heard it on the radio. Larry Elder had come on, I think, and I was listening to the radio, and he was talking about this case. And I was like, wait a second, I'm a bit of a news junkie, and I feel like if somebody had killed 18 people, Like, I would have heard about this. And I'm going to be honest with you. It was not on my radar. I haven't brought this story to you yet. But this happened in Birmingham, Alabama. And this guy's now been charged with murdering 18 people. 18. Let me just pause for a second. 18 people. I'm struggling to wrap my head around, and I'm sure you're struggling to wrap your head around that number. That is a huge number. This is the deadliest murderer in Alabama history. 18 people. His name is Damian McDaniel, and he's been charged with some of the most despicable crimes, including a murder for hire plot of a firefighter. His name is Jordan Melton in 2023. And then there were two different 2024 quadruple homicides. Okay, in 2024. That's eight people in 2024 at least, and then one guy in 2023. So, wow. Really scary stuff. This hasn't really made national headlines, though. I don't know why the mainstream media is not talking about this. This guy killed 18 people. So one can't help but wonder, I mean, why hasn't this been a bigger story? What is it about this killer? What is it about him? So where has the mainstream media been? They've been asleep, of course, at the wheel, as usual. Why? Because it doesn't fit their narrative. Okay, you see, the alleged murders were not carried out by a white guy. They weren't carried out by white supremacists or MAGA fans. The media yawns when, you know, perps and the victims of the perps are black. So this guy's black. A lot of his victims were black, almost all black of these 18 people. His name is Damian McDaniel in Birmingham over the past 2 years. So they're thinking that most of these murders happened over the past 2 years, which is crazy. I mean, I'd imagine it takes a lot of energy to kill, I don't know, but I'd imagine, and that is crazy that he had just in 2 years' time taken 18 lives from this planet. That's 18 sons or daughters from this planet, 18, you know, sisters, brothers. This is really sad stuff, and I don't think you've heard of him. Let me know in the comment section if you've heard of him. If not, I think I've rest my case here. Mainstream media won't talk about this guy. So McDaniel, he actually took to Facebook. And, you know, I'm not going to, you know, acknowledge this a ton because this Facebook post, hey, he's a monster, alleged monster, I should say that. But he is insisting that some of law enforcement's investigative tactics were problematic on social media. He took Facebook and started to complain, really. And, you know, I'm going to give it very little attention here. I'll share it with you in the comment section after I get through some of it. But I'll read some of the post and recite some of the post, because really, this just reads like a total failure who refuses to accept accountability and responsibility for his evil ways. And I don't think it really deserves acknowledgement. He killed 18 people, allegedly. So this is what the Facebook post says. I want to send my condolences to those who have been affected by these accusations. I'm not speaking clarity, and I'm definitely not asking for pity. This is for me because I see how the world is trying to portray me to be. And no, I'm not mad, but I will not allow you to defame my character. I wasn't gone, say, or try to clear up the assumptions. But the truth is that this situation takes a toll on more than just me and my family. My uncle has been targeted, and that resulted in a shooting. And my mother was at home and was shot at. So he took to Facebook, and I mean, I didn't quite understand. A lot of it's riddled with grammatical errors. And to be honest with you, I mean, I'll just sum it up for you. This long, long Facebook post, he's trying to be the victim here. He's trying to play like he's the victim, or let on that he's like a victim in this case. And the national media has gone completely silent about this guy. His name's Damian McDaniel. And he killed in just slightly over 2 years, 18 people. And almost all of those people, like I said, were all Black. And he's on trial now. If convicted, he will be the deadliest killer in Alabama history. And there are complete crickets on this story. Why? Because the perp and the victims, they were the wrong race. They were Black. And, you know, separately, I want to talk about this, and this has taken social media by storm. She ran from the Ukraine war, and maybe you've seen this case, but she ran from the Ukraine war. She's an actual refugee, and she came here for safety. Now, some of these refugees, they'll claim refugee status, but actually they kind of country hop is the term. An actual refugee is somebody who flees persecution, either religious persecution or flees a war-torn country, right? That's actual refugee status. And you actually go to the country in which you apply for the refugee status right away. So some of these refugees I take issue with, because they'll come from like Romania, then they'll go to Spain, then they'll go to Mexico, and then they'll come to the United States. The true definition of somebody who's seeking asylum or obtaining a refugee status, they come to the country in which they are seeking refuge for, like, only. And they don't country hop. They don't try to get to the United States. They come to the United States and seek refuge. And they actually have a reason to flee their country. This woman has a reason to flee her country. It's a torn, been torn, war-torn country. So America failed her. An immigrant, an actual immigrant, refugee. She's 23 years old, Irina Zarutska. Irina was butchered on a Charlotte light rail. Okay, so she was taken like a train, and her throat was cut open by a violent repeat offender who's been arrested 14 times, but yet was out free. This wasn't random. This was totally preventable. And there is a war on white people. Her blood is on the hands of a system who lets out violent criminals and lets them roam while innocent people pay the price. Okay, so they won't talk about this woman. And I'll share the footage with you. Smash that like button. This is really disturbing to see. There's no, like, the actual action is skipped where her throat is slit, but you'll see where he slits her throat and then walks away. There's blood dripping everywhere. So fair warning, this is graphic. So this is very evil, very deliberate. If Irina were Black and if her killer were white, the media would be rioting nonstop. They would be talking about this nonstop. But because she's white, they stayed silent, and because the perp is Black, they stayed silent. Let's take a look at this footage. And like I said, it's disturbing.
So comes in, sits down. It's her only crime, is sitting down next to this guy.
Okay, right here. Skips forward a bit, and this is when, like, you can see the blood spot a splatter on the ground. It's dripping off of the knife. Okay, so he walks past a bunch of people, which is a whole nother issue here. I don't understand how these people aren't, like, screaming and fleeing for their lives. I mean, they must be really immune to violent criminals just roaming about with bloody knives. I don't know. But if it was me, I'd be screaming and losing my absolute mind on this train if I saw somebody with a bloody knife and blood droplets all over the ground. So Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker, California Governor Gavin Newsom, and other Democrats, they're going to tell you that there's no crime, okay, and that there's no crime problem, and they're going to continue to defy President Donald Trump's efforts to end lawlessness in our city streets. And this is a story. I brought actually two of these stories. Now, this guy, what is his name? I got to get his name here. Damaros or something like that. I can't remember. I really just don't even pay attention to these people's names because I don't want to acknowledge them even further. But we have to point out that this kind of stuff is happening. So Governor J.B. Pritzker, he's going to continue to say that there's no crime problem, and he's going to continue to defy President Donald Trump's efforts to end the lawlessness in our city's streets. And this story, these two stories that I shared with you, it should serve as a reminder that, hey, there is a very serious crisis in our nation's inner cities, and we need to address it. So this was in Charlotte, this woman, the Ukrainian woman who had her throat slit. 18 people, by the way, in the previous case. These are two separate cases. I was talking about Damian McDaniel, 18, is what he's accused with killing, 18 people. And I can't even really cope with that number. Rest assured, however, you'll never hear about it from the acolytes and the corrupt corporate media. You'll never hear that number. You're never going to hear about Damian McDaniel or this guy who slit the throat of this Ukrainian refugee. To them, it's as if these incidents never happen, simply because the perp is black and the victims, they don't care about these victims because this was a white woman. Had she been killed by a white man and she was black, this would be all over the media. All right, I want to shift gears here. Let's talk about Amy Coney Barrett. She defended the 2022 Dobbs decision that overturned Roe v. Wade, saying that this is a state's rights issue. We've always talked about that. The overturning of Roe v. Wade, this doesn't stop abortion outright, which is just crazy that leftists, you know, say that this is an attack on abortion. No, really, it's just left up to the democratic process, you know, your state lawmakers here in the state of Illinois. They went even further. And I mean, I take issue with a little bit of what Barrett had said here. I don't think that the Dobbs decision went far enough. We really need to make this stuff illegal, or what Illinois is doing should not be able to go on. We have 12-year-olds who are fleeing from other states, coming to this state to seek an abortion, and they're skirting their state's laws, okay? And we can't prosecute them or prosecute healthcare providers for providing residents of other states abortions. We can't do that. So we've got 12-year-olds who are getting taxpayer-funded abortions, 12-year-olds from Indiana, from, you know, Georgia, whatever, coming here to the state of Illinois to get their taxpayer-funded abortion at the age of 12, and they don't have to inform their parents because we don't have parental notification here in the state. We've gone so far with the abortion issue. At this point, you have to, if you are a college campus pharmacy or a student health center, you have to provide medication that's not even really approved by the FDA. These are chemical abortions that have caused women to hemorrhage. They're dangerous. Abortion pills, misoprostol and mifepristone, these taken together, is not approved by the FDA, by the way. We've shifted from the FDA standard here in the state of Illinois when it comes to the abortion pills, and we've gone to the WHO, the World Health Organization, which, by the way, they're not made up of medical professionals or doctors like the FDA. They are a bunch of Chinese bureaucrats that make up the World Health Organization. And we're going to go off their standards now here in the state of Illinois. So I'm going to be honest, something needs to be done at a federal level. We can't just toss up our hands and say, yeah, let's leave it up to the democratic process because there's murder happening. And then on top of that, not just murder, but we are at the state of Illinois, we are saying, screw you. There's a law that was recently passed. We said that they're called shield laws, where we shield people who are, you know, breaking the laws of their state and then fleeing to this state to get their taxpayer-funded abortion. And we can't prosecute, you know, healthcare providers here in the state of Illinois, or we can't extradite, you know, healthcare providers to other states if they, you know, flee here and perform abortions. Like, we're trampling all over other states' laws, and we're, you know, kind of giving the big old screw you to states. And like, this is just not good for due process. It sets a nasty precedent that, you know, we're kind of not working or cooperating with the other states in the nation. We are the United States of America. So we can't just throw up our hands and say, oh, let's leave it up to the states. In my opinion, we need something that says, hey, we need some sort of line. Okay, because some of these states, like Illinois, have gone way, way too far with it. And they're trampling all over other states' laws, and they're thumbing their noses at other states' laws, and we are allowing children to cross over the border into the state of Illinois, pretty much be trafficked here, or they flee, you know, their home state. Somebody comes and brings them here for an abortion without their parents' consent. They get a taxpayer-funded abortion. I mean, that's another state. If they go after the said individual for kidnapping, say the parents, you know, didn't know that their daughter was going to come to the state of Illinois for abortion, and didn't know who was taking their daughter out of the state for the abortion, they could, you know, ask for the whatever state that girl was coming from, say like Georgia. They could ask the state of Georgia to pursue a kidnapping charge, but the state of Illinois shields that kidnapper and shields people who bring young girls over here for abortions. So you see where this starts to become problematic, because that interferes with other states' ability to perform due process or to prosecute their laws and to investigate. So the shield law is very un-American and flat out, I think, just unconstitutional. It's you can't interfere with other states and their laws and their right to prosecute criminals, like their obligation to prosecute criminals. So we can't just throw up our hands anyway. So during an interview on CBS Face the Nation yesterday, Sunday, she was on with host Amy Coney Barrett, Nora O'Donnell. And Barrett said that the justices just have to tune out the noise from critics like former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Dobbs did not render abortion illegal. Yes, we know that. I don't think Dobbs went far enough. We need something at a federal level, whether Congress passes it, whether, you know, it's, I think that's really where it has to, I don't think an executive order, they're just ignoring Trump's executive orders anyway. It would be shut down by an activist judge like that. But I think if Congress were to pass something like federal limit, something, because the state of Illinois has just run amok, okay, on the abortion issue. It's just gone crazy and it's descended into chaos after the Dobbs decision. And we're starting to see that play out. So, I mean, yes, I'm glad that Roe v. Wade is overturned, but it's kind of created like a disaster here in the United States, because now you have states that have gone so far where they are taking a crap on other states' laws, and they are interfering with their ability to prosecute individuals accordingly. So they're taking to a very far extreme the Dobbs decision. So Dobbs didn't say anything about whether abortion is immoral. It didn't say anything like that. It just leaves the questions up to the state. Okay, so Dobbs said that these are questions that should be left up to the states. And, you know, all of these questions, this is what Amy Coney Barrett says, decisions that you mentioned that require, you know, medical judgments are not ones that the Constitution connects to the courts, you know, to decide how far into a pregnancy the right of abortion might extend. So this is what Amy Coney Barrett says that Dobbs says. And I'd like to push back on that because there is no right to abortion. Like how far those rights extend, you know, a 12-year-old without parental notification, things like that here in the state of Illinois, we're extending those rights. And there is no such thing as a right to an abortion. And I'd have to push back on that. I don't think that's what Dobbs says. I don't think it says that there was a right to abortion. It just says that states have to decide, how to answer some of these questions, like, you know, the restrictions as far as restricting abortion. And this is what Coney Barrett says, you know, the court was in the business of drawing a lot of those lines before. And what Dobbs says is that those calls are properly left to the democratic process and that states have been working those out, those calls, those lines, and drawing those lines. There's been a lot of legislative activity and a lot of state constitutional activity since the decision in Dobbs was rendered. This is what Barrett said. So she kind of like, and I'm not no fan of Amy Coney Barrett, by the way. Can you tell? She sits there and she says, you know, it's up to the states to kind of decide how far into the pregnancy the right of abortion might extend. There is no such thing as a right of abortion. So she's wrong there. And I think that, you know, she's just kind of describing the Dobbs decision, which is what a judge should do in her position. She shouldn't really be advocating, but we as conservatives and our legislators should be advocating for a federal line to be drawn because it's gotten way out of hand after the Dobbs decision. And to be frank with you, I don't like the overturning of Roe v. Wade so much because we didn't replace it with anything good. We've got states that are going so far with these legislative calls and making these legislative calls and drawing these lines. In Illinois' case, they're just erasing lines and not putting any lines up. So O'Donnell, this CBS Face the Nation host, Nora O'Donnell, asked Amy Coney Barrett about the criticism from folks like Clinton regarding the Roe v. Wade being overturned. And she says, quote, people say a lot of things. So when it comes to Hillary Clinton, for example, you know, she says, what's next? She said, my prediction is that the court will do the gay marriage, due to gay marriage, what they did to abortion. O'Donnell said, so that's what Hillary Clinton says. She says that that's her prediction. The court is going to do the same thing that they did gay marriage with abortion, which, I mean, like I said, abortion is not outlawed. If anything, it kind of made it worse in some states, like the state of Illinois, where they have taken the liberty that, you know, the Dobbs decision affords them, and they have kind of went a mile with it. They were given an inch with the Dobbs decision, and they went a mile with it. So, again, you know, Hillary Clinton, her criticism here is that, hey, my prediction is that the court is going to do the same thing with the gay marriage. Okay. Like, so what? You know, and in some cases, it will probably go really, really far. I think some states like gay marriage can't pursue gay marriage unless you've been together for a certain X amount of years or whatever. They won't recognize at the state. You have to have X amount of years together in order to enter like a partnership or a marriage. In order to prevent like, you know, friends getting together and things like that, you have to actually prove that you're kind of gay, right, in order to get married. So a lot of that will probably, you know, some states will, you know, double down on that and make more restrictions for gay marriage. And like that's up to the states. Yes, it's a democratic process and it should be left up to the democratic process. I mean, me personally, I don't think that marriage is, it's like this is between man and woman. It's something ordained by God and you do before God. And gay marriage, like, is quite literally an oxymoron. But O'Donnell, she kind of brought up Hillary Clinton's criticisms here, and Barrett responded with this. She says, I think people who criticize the court, who are outside, you know, the court, say a lot of different things. But again, the point that I make in the book, so she's got a book that came out, is that we have to tune these kinds of things out. So she's got a new book. It's called Listening to the Law, Reflections on the Court and the Constitution. And it's slated for release here tomorrow. And she's scheduled to kind of give a talk about the book at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in California. And, you know, the Free Press, they actually printed a little piece from her book where Barrett fired a shot at all of these activist judges that let their personal views guide their judgment in the law. She says this in the book. Okay, she wrote, like Americans more generally, judges hold diverse views about the values by which a just society should live. Yet under the Constitution, the choice between these competing views is made by citizens in a democratic process, not by judges settling disputes. Yeah. I would agree with that. She goes further. She says, on the bench, we must suppress our individual beliefs. I don't know if I would necessarily agree with that. How can you suppress your individual beliefs? I think that that's kind of impossible to do to an extent, right? Now, you should try your best to remain impartial, but, you know, I would say that if Amy Coney Barrett is a Christian, she should definitely allow her Christian values to kind of seep into her decision making. You can't separate yourself from your Christian values. You can't separate yourself from who you are, which is comprised up of your values and belief system, right? So, I don't know. I think it's kind of naive to take that approach. She goes, our job is to protect the choices citizens have made, even when we disagree with them. The judges are referees, not kings, because they decide whether people have played by the rules rather than what the rules should be. So they decide whether people have played by the rules rather than what the rules should be. And I'm sure liberal heads are going to explode over that as more and more progressives find out what she has to say in this book. I'll say it. I think that, you know, the Dobbs decision didn't go far enough. I think that Congress should definitely, and that is leaving it up to the democratic process and not up to these judges. But 100%, I'm sure that these judges who overturned Roe v. Wade, their values definitely weren't separated at all. Like, yeah, you can claim that, but you can't separate your values and your belief system from who you are and your decision making as a judge. You really can't. Now you can do your best to protect the choices that the citizens have made, even though you might disagree with them. And you can do your best to suppress your individual beliefs. But I think that there is a reality, and then there's, you know, trying to separate or be as impartial as possible. So I'm sure the liberal heads are going to explode at some of the things she says in her new book. Yes, it's not up to the judges to, you know, legislate. And that's kind of what they did with the gay marriage issue and even with the abortion issue, the Roe v. Wade. It returns it back to the states and they play it out in the democratic process. I would say that, you know, federally, there has to be some sort of line drawn because you're going to have states like Illinois that go to the extremes. For example, in the gay marriage thing, you know, if you're pro-gay marriage, what if there's a state that goes to the extreme and just, you know, outright bans it? You kind of want a federal law there to, you know, define, hey, these are the parameters. Illinois, you can't stomp on other states' laws or trample all over other states' laws and due process or prosecution powers. You can't trample all over those. You have to cooperate with them if they want to extradite somebody back to their state for taking a 12-year-old girl to the state of Illinois for an abortion. And they're going to extradite them for kidnapping or whatever it is, human trafficking. you have to comply with their laws as well. And you have to respect their laws. Like, there has to be some sort of line. All right. So let's move on. Smash that like button. Share this out with your friends. I will be taking a quick break. But when we come back, we are going to be getting into this story. The higher education funding here in the state of Illinois is just run amok. Taxpayers are paying top dollar for empty classrooms. There are a lot of kids, students, who choose states like Indiana, Iowa, Ohio. They choose those states to go pursue their four-year degrees. And our admission rate, like kids being enrolled here in the state of Illinois, have completely just fell off. Like, they are dropping at record to record lows. But yet we're spending far more on higher education. So we're going to be talking a little bit about that. Smash that like button. Share this out with your friends. I'll be right back. Hey, you're listening to the Conservative Cat Clips. This is the place where we don't call 911 first. Nope, we pray, we prepare, and yes, we pack heat. Every time there's a tragedy, the media and the Democrats, they start crying, do something, and do something. And what they mean is more laws, more bans, and more restrictions, not on criminals, mind you, but on law-abiding citizens. So let me tell you what evil doesn't care about. They don't care about legislation. The man willing to break the sixth commandment, thou shalt not murder, doesn't blink twice at your AR-15 ban. Okay, he doesn't read your gun-free zone signs. He sees those signs and he says, this is an invitation for me. Gun control doesn't stop evil. It disarms good people. The founding fathers didn't give us the Second Amendment so we could go hunting. They gave us the Second Amendment to protect ourselves against tyrants, both foreign and domestic. And newsflash, tyrants don't tend to announce themselves. They come wearing smiles and waving around fancy policies. And I also want to talk about self-defense today. Self-defense. The average police response time in big cities like Chicago could be up to 10 minutes, sometimes even longer. I know the Chicago PD is really struggling with that. Response times in rural areas, it could get up to even 30 minutes response time. So if somebody kicks down your door, are you going to ask them to wait until the government sends backup to protect you, or are you going to protect your family and take matters into your own hands? So grandma, okay, in Peoria, Illinois, she is just trying to defend her property, but yet she's the one treated like a criminal. She has to go through all kinds of crazy background checks, permits, training. And the thug in Chicago, he gets the gun out of his trunk in an alley, and he didn't think twice about our laws, okay? It's about power. It always has been. Every dictatorship in history has disarmed their citizens first. That's Stalin, that's Hitler, that's Mao. They didn't want competition. And once the guns were gone, so were the rights, the freedom, and the people. So a disarmed people is a controlled people. But an armed, faithful, and free people, that is a nightmare for tyrants. And really, it's a blessing to your neighbors if you are armed. The Second Amendment isn't outdated. It's eternal. And just like evil, just like our right, just like the evil has the right to do evil things and that they will, we have the right to resist evil and to arm ourselves. And the Second Amendment is pretty dang clear, shall not be infringed. This has been Conservative Cat Clips. Hey, welcome back to the Conservative Cat Show. I so do appreciate you being here today. Subscribe, hit the subscribe button. And this is the show where the truth comes out. The truth gets claws, corruption gets scratched, and America's first values, they always sit in the host chair, okay? So America first values, we've got them here at the Conservative Cat Show. Be sure to subscribe, and you can support the program by sending a super chat. I'll get to your super chats here in just a second. But subscribe and support the program by visiting patriotpumpenergy.com, getting your bottle of Patriot Pump for $10 off at checkout using promo code Conservative Cat. Now let's talk about Illinois and how they want to brag. Illinois is bragging about being number one in higher education funding. We're number one in higher education funding. Okay, that sounds impressive, except here's what they don't tell you. Students are gone. Classrooms are empty. They've vanished. They've packed up their bags. They've crossed state lines. They've gone to states like Indiana. They said, sorry, Illinois, I'll take my diploma and get my diploma in Indiana instead. I'll take my high school diploma and go to Indiana and get my college education there, my higher education there. Thank you very much, Illinois. But see ya. And you, the taxpayer, you're still paying top dollar for empty classrooms, ballooning pensions, and administrative bloat thicker than Governor J.B. Pritzker's lunch menu. Okay, so today we are digging into why Illinois is spending billions, although there are fewer students. Okay, we're spending billions on fewer students. This is how a system robs families, and this is why it's a moral failure. We're going to be talking about why it's a moral failure, because this is just beyond, you know, a policy issue, a spending issue. This is a moral failure and, in fact, sinful. So buckle up. This is going to be one that stings, probably stings worse than the tuition hikes for some of our college students who might be listening. Smash that like button. Okay, let's get straight to the facts. Since 2009, Illinois has lost more than 106,000 college students. So since 2009, let me repeat that. Illinois has lost more than 106,000 college students. That's a figure out of the center square. That's not a blip, by the way. That's an exodus. Okay. And yet, at the same time, Springfield cranked up the higher ed spending by over $2 billion within that time period. So, former state representative now at the Illinois Policy Institute, Mark Batnick, he says it very plainly. Quote in the Center Square, Illinois is number one in per student spending, double the national average, and gets 43 cents of every dollar goes to pensions. Okay. Not classrooms, not teachers, not labs, not scholarships, pensions. So that's where all of the money is going. You might be wondering, where did that $2 billion go? Largely it's going to pensions. Okay. So while your kid, you know, goes to off to college, is working a job, a part-time job to try to afford $15,000 a year tuition, administrators are sipping on cocktails at retirement parties paid for by your tax dollars, okay? That is what's going on. They're charging tuition. They're also charging the taxpayers for these public universities, taxing you to death for these pensions, for these retirement plans, and they're sipping their cocktails at their retirement parties. And your kid is busting his ass to try to make it and try to afford $15,000 a year tuition. So here's the kicker. Illinois' funding model doesn't follow enrollment, which is a big problem. So say a university is losing students by, you know, the handfuls in droves. There's mass exodus at this university. They still get their funding like nothing even happened. It doesn't matter that they're losing students like crazy. University's growing, too bad. We're not going to reward you for that. And that is socialism. That is socialism for universities. Failure gets rewarded and success gets punished. They don't get anything extra for gaining enrollment. So let's talk about the cost. In 2009, in-state tuition averaged about $9,400. Okay, today, it is about $15,400. Now, I am being very generous. This is in-state tuition, public universities. Some of them are a little bit higher than that. I went to school for a little bit higher than that, higher than $15,000. And I went to Illinois State University. Average, we're talking $15,400 is the average. Now, that is a 64% increase since 2009. Okay, families can't keep up. Students are voting with their feet. Nearly half of Illinois high school grads who go to a four-year school leave the state. Let me repeat that for you. Nearly half of high school students who graduate, they go to a four-year. If they go to the four-year, nearly half of them go and they leave to states like Indiana, Wisconsin, Iowa. And really, they're stealing these states. Not stealing, but they are competing and they're taking these Illinois kids with cheaper tuition. So they are offering cheaper tuition. That is why Illinois students are going to these states, because they have cheaper tuition. So, you know, this isn't just about money. It's the future. Families want their kids to be educated close to home, where they can, you know, be by, you know, their parents and be surrounded around their values, their faith, and their family ties stay intact. When these college students leave, they might not ever come back, and that family tie might be severed. Their values might change if they're not, you know, around home. And Illinois politicians, they are simultaneously obsessed with feeding the bloated bureaucracy, and they are pushing families apart. So this is a spiritual issue as much as it is an economic issue. When you rob young people of an opportunity to be educated near home, and then you drive them into debt or out of state altogether, that's a betrayal of the Christian duty of stewardship. Government isn't stewarding its resources. They're squandering them. So they're taxing you. The tuition's really high. They're taxing you, and all of that's kind of going towards pensions. We talked about that. 43 cents on the dollar is going towards pensions. According to Illinois policy, more than 10% of higher ed funding was wasted on administrative bloat. Not professors, not research, not students, not labs. Nope, layers and layers of administrators who are inventing diversity seminars, climate action plans, and gender-neutral dorm committees, right? Committee here, committee there. We're going to pay people to serve on these committees and, come up with these diversity seminars and these climate action plans. And let's be honest, Illinois universities, they aren't even really universities anymore. They're not prioritizing the students or the research or the professors. They're actually just HR departments with a side of classrooms. So this has become a place where people can get these public sector, these cushy public sector jobs, get these nice pensions. And it's not even a place of real academics anymore, or true academics and learning. This is a place where losers who didn't make it in the private sector can go, and they can land themselves a cushy job. And it's essentially an HR department at the side of classrooms. So hardworking families are being told to shut up, pay the taxes, continue to pay the higher taxes that largely go to the pensions, and accept that your kids are either going to leave Illinois because it's way too high, the tuition is way too high, and the taxation is insane. You as parents are just going to have to accept that your kids are going to leave the family, sever the family ties, or they're going to have to drown in debt if they stay here. Okay. So folks, that's not education. That's indoctrination funded by extortion. to put it blank, point blank. So let's dig our claws in deeper. This isn't just about policy and spending. Like I said, $2 billion since 2009. I mean, and at the same time, enrollment has been dwindling. 106,000 students have left. What was it? The statistic. College students have lost that many college students since 2009. This isn't just about policy. This is about sin. Yes, I said it, sin. Because what is sin? Squandering blessings, abusing stewardship, and putting man's vanity above God's order. Illinois is stealing from its people. Taxpayers sacrifice so that the universities can waste it on the administrative bloat. Parents sacrifice so that the administrators can thrive and they can have these cushy little jobs. Students sacrifice so that the politicians can brag about being number one in higher education funding. And what did Jesus say? Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. So, well, Illinois' treasure is in the bureaucracy and in the pensions. Okay, it's not in the students. It's not invested in the education of these students. It's not invested in the truth. And the truth is that these colleges should serve as learning hubs. They're not investing in these learning hubs. They're investing in these people and these bureaucrats and the administrators at the tippity top, so that way they don't have to go out and actually contribute to society in the private sector. Okay, so what's the fix here? We have to tie funding to enrollment. Okay, so if universities are losing enrollment and losing students, then they shouldn't keep the same funding. We should tie the funding to the university or to the enrollment. And if the university loses students, cut their funding. Okay, and reward the ones who are actually educating where students want to go. Okay, slash the administrative bloat. That's number two. That's how we fix this. It's really not all that complicated. Okay, tie the funding to the enrollment. Done. Slash the administrative bloat. Fire the armies of bureaucrats pushing the woke nonsense and doing these diversity seminars. You have to redirect that money to classrooms, to labs, to real professors who are dedicated to learning. And we need pension reform, which I say all the time. I think pretty much every show. Smash that like button if you want pension reform. Sorry, Springfield, you can't keep treating the taxpayers like an ATM. You got to fix the system. People who are new hires, they should be on 401k style plans. Okay, not these lifetime gold-plated pensions. There's no reason why a superintendent should be getting paid a pension of $200,000, specifically a superintendent. I'm talking about the District 87 one, $200,000 pension plan. And he was serving in a district much smaller than the Peoria School District. This was Bloomington. There was like nine schools in that district, whereas Peoria has like double, not triple almost, that amount of schools. And then the current superintendent is making $100,000 in a salary. There's no reason for these gold-plated pensions. Put them on 401k style plans, not these top-tier Cadillac plans. So we can't keep treating taxpayers like an ATM. Okay, school choice for higher ed. What we could do, which would be really cool, vouchers or tax credits to send kids to schools that serve them the best. Okay, so in-state or out-of-state. This would force Illinois universities to kind of compete. Okay, hey, we're going to give you tax credit through our higher education school choice program. That would really like light a fire under the asses of Illinois State or Illinois universities. They'd be like, oh man, people are getting money now, tax credits or vouchers even, for choosing schools either in-state or out-of-state that they like best and that suit them best. We really want to be chosen through this voucher program or this tax credit program. We really want to be chosen, and that would force them to kind of compete and to be the best, so that way students choose them. And last but not least, we need to bring faith and family back. Education without values is indoctrination. Families need to demand universities respect the parents, faith, and truth. Otherwise, they lose funding, period. And I think the Trump administration and Pam Bondi specifically are very dedicated to that. Like, hey, this DEI stuff, the affirmative action stuff, awarding scholarships based on race, that is, you know, anti-truth, anti-family, anti-faith. Like, that's just blatantly racist. And you know, the Bible talks about that kind of stuff. Like, hey, you shouldn't be racist. And they're cutting the funding. The feds are, anyway, for those types of universities who aren't respecting, parents' faith and truth, and they're pushing this DEI nonsense. They're losing their federal funding, and we need to keep at that. We need to demand that faith and family stay in education, specifically in higher education. Illinois needs to stop pretending that money is the answer to all of their problems. Stewardship is the answer. Responsibility is the answer. And truth is the answer. In closing, folks, Illinois is proof that throwing money at a broken system doesn't fix it. It feeds it. Okay. The politicians, they brag about being number one in higher ed spending. That's kind of like a drunk bragging about how much he spent at the bar last night. Okay, big spender, but no results. Okay, you can spend as much as you want on booze, you know, as a drunk, and because your tolerance is a little bit higher, you're gonna have like, you know, no results from that. So you can be a big spender and no results. Drunks do it all the time when they go to the bar. So families are bleeding, students are fleeing, and the system is crumbling. And there is good news, though. The truth always claws its way out. Families are starting to wake up to this. In fact, I'd say that more and more students are choosing not to go to college after they graduate high school. And they're entering, I think that we're going to have this new age, this golden age, where we're going to really start to see students enter the trades, become plumbers, become beauticians, become waitresses, you know, some of these jobs that just keep America humming. I think that there's going to be a focus on those types of jobs now. And I'm really excited because then hopefully, you know, under Trump's in America here, that those jobs are going to be enough to make ends meet. And I think that students are going to be choosing that way of life over the way of life where you enter higher ed and then you wind up like entering the public sector or becoming an administrator or becoming an HR guy. I think that we're going to prioritize more so this blue collar work and abandon higher education altogether. So if Illinois doesn't reform right now, it'll be left with empty campuses. Like that is what we're facing right now. Empty campuses, bloated pensions, and a legacy of failure. I do want to take a quick break, but we're going to be right back. And I want to talk a little bit about Jesse Jackson's boy, Jonathan Jackson. He's an Illinois congressman, and he got caught weeks late reporting 31 stock trades made by his wife. So you're supposed to report this stuff. We're going to talk about how 95%, this is a staggering number, 95% of Americans want to see congressmen not able to trade, ban them from trading stocks. So you can't get 95% of Americans to agree on anything. Okay, so we're going to be chatting a little bit about this because there is a crew now, a Democrat is now pushing for members of Congress and their families to be banned from trading stocks. This has been out like for years now, and I don't know why we haven't moved on this. I think that this is just more lip service, and excuse me if I don't jump on the reform is coming bandwagon, and like I'm so excited about Raja Krishnamurthy, which is an Illinois congressman. I'm not jumping for joy because I don't think reform is coming anytime soon. This is just more lip service. I'll be right back. Welcome to Conservative Cat Clips, where we deal with the truth, not talking points. I'm your host, Kat, and today we're putting a spotlight on something the abortion industry wants to keep you in the dark about. Abortion pills. What are they? How do they work? And how are they hurting women? Let's talk about the facts. Over 54% of abortions in America are now done using chemical abortion pills. That number is climbing fast. Why? Because it's easier, it's cheaper, and it's quieter. But here's what they won't tell you. Abortion pills come with a serious risk. The process is two drugs, mifepristone, which actually ends the pregnancy, and misoprostol, which forces the body to expel the baby. Sounds simple, right? It's not. According to the FDA, 4,200 serious adverse events have been reported, including 28 deaths since 2000, the year 2000. And those are just the official numbers. In 2021, there was a peer-reviewed study that found that ER visits after chemical abortions increased by over 500% between 2002 and 2015. And here's the kicker. Many of these cases are coded as miscarriages, and they're coded as miscarriages because women don't or they can't tell the hospital what actually happened and that they actually took these pills. That means the real damage, probably much worse, so way more than 4,200 adverse events since 2000. Now brace yourself. The Biden administration made it to where these pills were accessible by the mail with no person exam, no ultrasound, and no guarantee that the pregnancy had to be an ectopic pregnancy. So, I mean, you could be taking these in your 6 months, 7 months, 8 months along. And it's not, this could be deadly if you take it when it's not an ectopic pregnancy. Women are being told to take these powerful drugs and there's zero medical supervision. That's not healthcare. It's called negligence. It's medical negligence. And we're seeing a heartbreaking stories about all these women who are bleeding alone in dorm rooms, bathrooms, parking lots, or even in their own cars in the parking lot. Clinics like Planned Parenthood calls this empowerment and empowering, but tell me how it's empowering to hand a teenager a handful of pills and say, good luck. The emotional fallout is just as real, by the way. There's a physical risk, but there's an emotional risk as well. Women reported feeling abandoned, traumatized, and even haunted by what they've done, especially when they see the tiny, tiny body of their baby passing. And passing that, it's traumatizing. And nobody tells them that they're going to see the tiny baby in the pamphlet. So here's the truth, the plain and simple truth. Abortion pills are not safe. They're not kind and they're not empowering. They actually hurt women and they silence their pain by taking these chemical abortion pills, and they protect an industry by keeping the abortion in the dark. And it doesn't do anything to protect the individual at all. I'm Kat, and this has been Conservative Clips, Kat Clips, reminding you that real healthcare, it doesn't kill people, and real healthcare means empowering women and supporting women, not selling them lies in a bottle. Stay alert, stay bold, and always choose life. This has been Conservative Kat Clips. Hey, go ahead and smash that like button, subscribe to the channel. I appreciate you being here. Hit the subscribe button right now. Like, love, share. Welcome back to the Conservative Kat Show, where corruption gets clawed, truth gets dragged into the light, and liberty always comes first. Let me ask you something. When you think of Congress, do you picture like the House of Representatives, the House floor, or do you think of it as a Vegas casino floor? Because lately, the difference is kind of hard to spot. Every time I think about Congress, I just think of it as like a Vegas casino floor. Chips on the table, insider odds stacked, and the American people are holding the losing hand. That is what's going on in Congress in Washington. And case in point, let's look at Illinois Congressman Jonathan Jackson. Yes, Jesse Jackson's boy. He got caught, according to the Center Square, late reporting 31 stock trades made by his wife. Don't worry, folks. It's only the law he broke. No big deal, right? It's your typical political family tradition. Rules for thee, but loopholes for me. So there's a law out there that says that you have to report it within X amount of days, but he didn't report it within, he reported it weeks late, the 31 stock trades made by his wife. Now, some in Congress are pretending to get serious about this, you know, and it's really annoying because there's been a bill out there for quite some time, like the Pelosi Act is what it's called. Josh Hawley has had this, even like AOC has been a proponent of this, and nothing has gotten done. Okay, with the Pelosi Act, it hasn't moved. Okay, and now you've got a bipartisan crew led by a Democrat. Now, this might actually, you know, like move because, you know, Democrats leading it, but we'll have to see. I mean, they don't have the majority right now in the House, but Illinois Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy, Morthy, I think is his name. He says it's time to ban members of Congress and their families from trading stocks. Well, where have I heard this before? Josh Hawley has already been, you know, and bipartisan people, like, this has already been talked about. And I know it sounds noble. And you're like, well, Kat, wouldn't you be for banning members of Congress and their families trading stocks? Yes, I am for that. But 95% of Americans are for that, by the way. But I've been watching this, for a long time. Decades and decades of insider trading has been going on. They've been wheeling and dealing. So forgive me if I'm not ecstatic or jumping up for joy when I hear reform is coming and, you know, we're leading a charge to try to ban members of Congress from trading. I'm not jumping on this bandwagon because I've heard the same song and dance over and over again. And I'm sorry, just because Raja, this Illinois congressman, is saying like, oh yeah, now we're going to really introduce it. Yeah, okay, give me a break. This is just lip service, okay? I'll believe it when I see it. So let's dig into Jonathan Jackson here, chaboy. He is the son of Jesse Jackson, elected out of the Chicago political machine. And he's already been caught cutting corners. He was supposed to disclose his family stocks within 45 days, but he was weeks late. 31 trades, not pennies. This is not lunch money. This is real money. And this is a symptom of something much deeper. When politicians get elected, they don't pack their Bibles. They don't, pack their Bibles, go to Washington, D.C. and, you know, uphold their oath of office. They don't do that. They often, you know, pack their Monopoly set, Wall Street Journal, and a handbook, How to Get Rich While Pretending to Serve the People handbook. That's what they pack, and then they wind up going to Washington, D.C. So let's not kid ourselves. Jonathan Jackson is not alone here with not reporting the stocks. I mean, dozens of lawmakers have done this. They've pulled the stunt over the past decade, both parties, Republican, Democrats alike. Hundreds of millions of dollars in Congress is kind of turned into a revolving door of legislation by day and insider trading by night. That's what's been going on in Congress. And everybody says that they want to do something, but nobody's actually done anything. We should get the Pelosi Act. Like, this is a non-issue because 95% of Americans agree that congressmen should not be insider or should not be trading or their families. You know, I think it needs to even go further, not just insider trading, but their families, the congressmen. So it's not public service, what they're doing there in Congress in Washington. This is legalized theft. So here comes Raja Krishnamurthy or Morthy or whatever his name is. He's an Illinois congressman. And he's like, Congress is not a casino. You know, it's not a stock exchange. That's what Raja says. Well, Raja, you're right. But here's the problem. It's been both. It's been a casino. It's been a stock exchange for quite some time now. And you've been sitting there, you know, in the casino lounge, sipping your cocktails, your free cocktails. Okay. You've been sitting there. Everybody in Congress has been sitting there. And now he's pushing the, quote, Restore Trust in Congress Act. Okay, that's a nice name. We have the Pelosi Act, by the way, already out there. And they always sound really nice, right? The Affordable Care Act or the Inflation Reduction Act. But here's the question. Does the bill actually have teeth? Or is this just another political chew toy they're throwing out there? And the plan here with this act, the Restore Trust in Congress Act, the plan is to ban members of Congress, their kids, their spouses, and their families from owning or trading stocks. Sounds strong, sounds exciting. They'd have to divest. The ethics office would enforce it, okay, the ban. And even AOC, you know, said that this feels like Washington working the way it's supposed to be working. AOC is on board with this. She's also been on board with the Pelosi Act, which does the same thing. And we've talked about this before. I don't know why we've got yet another one out there. Let's just get the Pelosi Act passed through, right? And forgive me for not fainting or jumping with joy or fainting with excitement. Washington working is like the Titanic. Was just, you know, testing submarine features, okay? It's like saying the Titanic was testing the submarine features of the ship. It's bogus, you know. They can say that they're working, and Washington is working like it should be, you know, with this act. Here's the real story. Representative Ana Paulina Luna out of Florida said it best. 95% of Americans support banning lawmakers from trading. 95%. That is a kind of consensus you cannot see in a country as divided as this one. And why is there 95% of Americans in agreement on this? Because they're not stupid. They see politicians raking in 600% returns while the rest of us are praying we don't lose our retirement savings. They see laws being written in the morning and portfolios are being adjusted by lunch. Okay, so President Donald Trump has even weighed in on this, and specifically he weighed in on the Pelosi Act, which was originally introduced by Josh Hawley. It was so brilliantly named the Pelosi Act. Let me pull up what it stands for. It's an acronym. It was genius. Hold on, let me pull this up on the fly. Prohibits members of Congress from holding certain investments. Preventing elected leaders from owning Securities and Investments Act. Okay, this was introduced by Senator Josh Hawley. Definitely bipartisan. And it hasn't gotten anywhere. So President Donald Trump has weighed in on that issue. And he supports a ban. Why? Because it's corrupt. Okay, period. He knows that the swamp doesn't just feed on the taxpayer dollars, okay, and bloat their bureaucratic agencies, their government agencies, and award their nonprofit friends and their little acolytes, okay, with taxpayer money. The swamp doesn't just feed on the taxpayer money. It feeds on insider advantages. And this isn't really left versus right, which is why you see 95% of Americans agreeing on this issue. This is really the elites versus the rest of us. And, you know, you can put a biblical lens on this, and I like to do that. This is what scripture warns about in Proverbs. Dishonest scales are an abomination to the Lord, but a just weight is to his delight. So Congress has been working with dishonest scales. Okay, they pass laws that move the markets, and they sneak off to profit from the very shifts that they caused. Okay. So that's not just unethical. That's theft in God's eyes, because you are having dishonest skills here. And when a father of four loses his retirement because Congress let inflation run wild with the Inflation Reduction Act and the American Rescue Plan Act, but his congressman's portfolio is somehow thriving, tell me, is that justice? Is that fair? Jesus flipped tables when the money changers corrupted the temple. Okay. Maybe it's time we start flipping congressional tables too. So what do we do? I'd like to bring this to you, a solution. Smash that like button, subscribe to the channel. What we need to do is just ban it. You know, enough of the lip service, enough of like people coming up with their own acts and passing their own acts and their own bills. Like, we just need to ban it, period. You know, 95% of Americans agree on this issue, not just for members, by the way, but for their spouses, for their kids. No loopholes. Okay. Blind trust only. If you want to serve the people, you put your money in a blind trust where you can't touch it until you're out. Okay. I'm okay with that. Blind trust only. Real penalties. So if you are caught insider trading, there shouldn't be like a $200 slap on the wrist, okay? Or if you don't file your stock trades like John Jackson did until weeks after the deadline, I don't want a slap on the wrist, man. I want you to be removed from office for cheating, okay? If you cheat, you're removed from office. And if you break public trust, you're gone. And there should honestly be jail time for this stuff. So transparency in real time. Every trade must be publicly reported within 24 hours. You know, they get like 45 days as is. And then you have some congressmen who thumb their noses at that rule, and then they don't even file until weeks after that deadline. No hiding, no delays. Sunshine disinfects corruption. We need to shine a light on this stuff, and they need to report when they publicly trade. If we're not going to do an outright ban, which we should do an outright ban, but for right now, what we need to do is ensure that they are reporting publicly within 24 hours if they're doing trades. Term limits, obviously, I'm for those because the longer these folks sit in power, the more ways they find to exploit their power. We need citizen legislators, not career gamblers. Term limits would probably help with a lot of this insider trading stuff because you're not building those relationships and you won't have the ability to move the markets and shift the markets and then therefore act by insider trading. So if Washington won't fix itself, the people need to claw back. We need to remove some of these career politicians by primarying them. So let's recap. This whole story was about Illinois Congressman Jonathan Jackson, who couldn't follow the law on reporting stock trades, it looks like. So Raja Krishnamurthy, who is this other Illinois congressman, suddenly is crying casino. And then, you know, the House of Reps is a casino, and he's promising reform. Americans across the board are fed up at this point. They've been promised reform, not just by this Raja, now this Raja person, but we were promised reform under Josh Hawley, and I don't know why they haven't passed that bill yet. So Americans are fed up across the board. They're not jumping for joy over this kind of stuff because we've seen the same song and dance over and over again, and they're just using this as lip service at this point, saying that they're going to ban members of Congress from trading stock. Congress isn't supposed to be a Wall Street brokerage. It's supposed to be the people's house. Until lawmakers put their money where their oath is, we can't trust them. Okay. And the good news is that Americans see right through this. 95% say enough is enough. And when that kind of unity rises up, even swamp rats start sweating, and then they have to start like saying things like they're introducing legislation to combat this. But at the same time, none of them have moved the needle at all. They just come up with these bills and then they name them these nice things and nothing ever happens. So I'm going to take a quick break, but we're going to come back. We're going to talk about Abby Phillip. Do you know who Abby Phillip is? She's on CNN. And you know what they say about blind squirrels and finding nuts. Even blind squirrels find nuts sometimes. So this is a left-wing host on CNN, and a lot of times she spends her, you know, time trying to lecture on the panel, you know, lecture Scott Jennings for being right about everything, Abby Phillips. So I don't really like to give Abby Phillips a ton of credit, but she actually had this rare act of journalism on the show when she was interviewing the communist from New York. He's the New York City mayoral candidate, Zohran Mamdani. And he's currently the favorite to win that position, by the way, which is wild to think. Needless to say, this was like watching a child explain quantum physics, this interview, where Zohran Mamdani had to try to explain his position on government-owned grocery stores and explain his proposal on government-owned grocery stores, and it didn't go well for him. It looked like a two-year-old trying to explain quantum physics to somebody. So we're going to get to that sit down between Abby Phillip and Mamdani because it's a good one. Smash that like button, share this out with your friends. Go ahead and smash that like button. Share this out with your friends. I'm going to take a drink of coffee here in a second. Yes. All right. So before we took the break, I was telling you a little bit about the communist, the New York City mayoral candidate, Zohran. He did a sit down with Abby Phillip, and Abby actually pressed him in this rare act of journalism, which she likes to spend most of her time on the CNN panel going after everything that Scott Jennings says, but in this rare act of journalism, she asks him about his government-owned grocery store proposal, and it didn't go well for him because he sat there and he looked like a little toddler trying to explain quantum physics. Let's take a listen to this. Here we go.
Why is the government a better solution for a lack of grocery stores, food deserts, than just working with the private sector to have them do what they know how to do, which is run grocery stores? What's your answer to that?
There are more than 1,000 grocery stores in New York City. I'm proposing creating 5 additional ones, one in each borough of New York City that the city would run, and that would guarantee cheaper groceries, not free food, but cheaper groceries. And part of that is because food is a necessity for New Yorkers. It's a necessity for everyone. And yet it's something that people are being priced out of. And we can see the promise and the possibility of a public option. And we've seen in studies that have been done about the applicability of this in an urban setting like Chicago, that this is something we can actually deliver right here in New York City.
But there was another example in Kansas City where they had a government-run grocery store. And it's been there for years, but it's on the verge of closing because it doesn't work. They've been riddled with crime. They've dealt with just a lack of inventory. There are other examples where it just hasn't worked because, frankly, the government is not that good at being in the business of being in grocery stores.
Okay. So what you heard there was Mamdani and Philip. They were having a conversation. Philip starts out with, hey, why is the government a better solution for the lack of grocery stores, food deserts, than just working with the private sector to have them do what they know how to do, which is run grocery stores? You know, what's your answer to that? That's what Philip had asked. And Mamdani said, well, there's more than 1,000 grocery stores in New York City. I'm proposing that we create 5 additional ones, one in each borough of New York City, that the city would run, that would guarantee cheaper groceries. Not free food, but cheaper groceries. And part of that would, part of that is because food is a necessity for New Yorkers. See, food is a right, healthcare is a right. That's what these socialists always say. Anything that takes time and effort of somebody else is not a right to you. Okay. Abortion is a right. If you have to have somebody come and kill your baby off, that is not a right that is afforded to you. Okay. First of all, second of all, it's murder anyway. So they constantly throw this kind of stuff out there. Food is a right and healthcare is a right. Yeah. But like, it takes the efforts of somebody else to provide you that food. Okay. For example, this grocery store, if you want food, you can go and grow your own. You don't have to go to the grocery store. You can do it yourself. So this is like straight up socialism. Yes, a necessity for everyone. It's all about, you know, are you going to take the personal responsibility to provide yourself food? That's not something that should be on the taxpayers. So he says it's a necessity for everyone, and yet it's something that people are being priced out of. And we can see the promise and the possibility of a public option. And we've seen the studies that have been done about the applicability of this in an urban setting like Chicago. That is something that we can actually deliver right here in New York City. That's what he's saying. And then Philip says, yeah, but like there's an example in Kansas City where there's a government grocery store and it's been there for years and it's on the verge of closing because it doesn't work. They've been riddled with crime. They've had to deal with a lack of inventory. And there are other examples where this hasn't worked. And frankly, the government is not that good at being in the business of grocery store or being in the business of being in grocery stores. Yeah, well, the government isn't really good at anything, okay? Grocery stores, probably not good at that either. We can guess, make an educated guess. They're not good at pretty much everything they do and provide. So it's incredible to me that our country has gotten to a place where this slick-talking communist Zohran Mamdani has actually got a chance, okay? And not a chance at dog catcher, but winning a major election, okay, even in the blue area of New York City. It still shocks me that he's getting this close and that he's kind of the favorite at this point. And I want to play this out for you, a government grocery store, okay, a government-owned grocery store, and what it would actually look like. So if you put 5 government-owned grocery stores, which is what he wants to do, government-owned and run grocery stores, and you spread them out over the city in New York, several things are going to happen. Let's play this out. If the groceries are truly cheaper, the stores are going to be overwhelmed. Okay. Once you outprice all of the neighboring grocery stores or these thousands of grocery stores that are in New York City, these are going to be overrun, these grocery stores, if they are actually cheaper. And they're going to be overwhelmed and it's going to be impossible to keep things in stock. So you're providing a cheaper product. People are going to flood the zone. Okay. And I know what communists are going to say. Good. That means, you know, that this is a success and that we have to open even more government-owned grocery stores. Okay. So the problem is that money isn't infinite. Okay. New York City will not be able to sell groceries at a loss forever. Okay. Money isn't infinite. If they're selling groceries at a loss, you know, there's a reason why the groceries are as high as they are. You know, there's some people who try to compete, you know, where they're selling groceries cheaper. A lot of times what you'll see is, like, for example, Walmart, they make a little bit things or little make things a little bit cheaper, like your milk, maybe your eggs, things like that. But then they really price some of their other items, like their clothing or other things that they sell. They really price those things high in order to kind of make up for that loss. That's how grocery stores kind of operate. But they don't sell everything at a loss forever. Okay, it's not sustainable. In fact, it's already been revealed that the funding Mamdani wants to use for this, the government-owned grocery stores, that it doesn't exist, because I don't know if he doesn't have the ability to read a government website properly, but he claims that there's millions sitting in a bank that doesn't actually exist. So he wants to use funds that don't actually exist to prop this thing up for a while. And you can do that for a while if you have the taxpayer funds. But money isn't infinite, and you can't sell the groceries at a loss forever. So that's why the Kansas City-run grocery store, which is run by Democrats and was approved by Democrats and is a city-owned grocery store, the Kansas City one, they basically turned it into this grocery store into a late Soviet era enterprise. And it's got empty shelves, steep funding shortfalls. They can't fund this thing in Kansas City. So we've already got examples of just not working. Mamdani, who has never really held a real job, by the way, and is a trust fund baby, I don't think he's really considered any of this. And he's just kind of being dishonest here. And in my apparent opinion, arrogant. It seems like he doesn't care about the real life consequences of government run or government owned and run grocery store, or the real life effects of this and like what it actually winds up being, which is a Soviet era looking grocery store where they're stuck, where the shelves are empty, and you're going to wind up hurting a lot of the grocery stores that exist. So say you open up a grocery store and you're selling groceries at a loss for a period of time, and you open up more and more and more grocery stores, government-owned grocery stores, because the Dems claim that, hey, it's working because we're having a hard time keeping the inventory. What's going to wind up happening is you're going to take away business from the private sector, and then those places are going to shutter their doors. And then, you know, you're going to run out of the money, out of the funding. There's going to be shortfalls in the funding, and you're not going to be able to fund these things anymore. So nobody's going to have any food anymore. Okay, that is the direction we're headed with the government-owned grocery stores. And I don't know about you, but I am so tired of having empty suits in government, people who are actual citizens, people who have never really held a job or even signed the front of a paycheck, business owners or employers. I'm really tired of sending those people to either Washington, Springfield, in this case, this would be New York City, to one of the, I'd say, major elections in the United States. We're seriously considering a communist, electing a smooth-talking communist to become mayor of that city, the major city. Let's take a listen to more of their interview. Here's what Mamdani said about crime. Let's take a listen.
Do you have a responsibility to do it first, to put cops on the street first, maybe to ask for the National Guard on the subways, as Kathy Hochul has done in the past?
We have a responsibility to address the struggles that New Yorkers are living through. And one thing I'll say about Donald Trump.
Do you have a responsibility to do it first?
Okay. So essentially what he said here was, do you have a responsibility to put cops on the street? And he said, well, let me tell you about Donald Trump. Let me deflect. But hey, you know, if this is really what New York City residents want, that's what you're going to get. You know, look at Europe. You can't save people who don't want to be saved. And You know, I feel like these New York City residents, they don't want to be saved. And they're going to let Mamdani go in there, and they're going to let him continue to let the crime explode. I mean, there was a woman who was set on fire, I think, in a subway, actually, last Christmas. Something crazy like that. I mean, the crime is rampant there. And he's going to blow out the budget to a point of ruin, complete ruin, because he says there's millions here to fund, but there's no account there. He says that there is an account there with millions sitting in it. There's not. So he's going to pull it out of somewhere, and he's going to destroy the budget to a point of ruin. And his communist utopia eventually will fail. If not, you know, in the very beginning, it definitely will. And the rest of us are going to be sitting here shrugging, and we're going to be like, sorry, New York residents. We tried to warn you that he was a smooth-talking communist. All right. Got to take a quick break, but stay right here because we are going to be talking about Donald Trump and this three-judge panel. So it was a Boston-based appeals, Circuit Court of Appeals, Boston-based first U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. They basically ruled that you can make up stuff on your passport. Donald Trump, ever since he retook the presidency, he's been trying to kind of combat the DEI stuff, the trans stuff. And part of that was saying, hey, we need to have male and female on our passports. And now this federal appeals court declined to allow the U.S. President Donald Trump's administration to refuse to issue passports to transgender and non-binary Americans that reflect their gender identities. So they said, hey, you know, we're not doing the whole gender identity thing. The Donald Trump administration said that we're going to classify them as male or female because there are two genders. You know, there's a whole host of problems that come with misidentifying people on documentation, legal documentation. You know, how do you identify the body if they have this identification on that driver's license? If your driver's license reflects your gender identity and not your true sex, it's going to complicate things if you, you know, get into a car accident. There's all kinds of problems that could arise if you allow for transgender non-binary individuals to lie essentially on their documentation and use their gender identity on legal documents. Okay, so that's why the Trump administration did it, because there's all kinds of consequences that come from lying on documentation, national security issues. Okay, but this U.S. Court of Appeals, Federal Appeals Court, they declined to allow President Donald Trump's administration to refuse to issue passports to transgender and non-binary Americans that reflect their gender identities rather than their true sex. So we're going to get to that. Smash that like button, share this out with your friends, and subscribe to the channel. We'll be right back. Hey, go ahead and smash that like button, share this out with your friends, subscribe to the channel right now, hit the subscribe button, share this out with that one friend, tell them about Conservative Cat, the Conservative Cat Show today. Let's talk about this three-judge panel of the Boston-based first U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. They declined to hold an injunction issued by a trial judge barring the U.S. Department of State from enforcing a policy it adopted at Trump's direction. Okay, so let me break this down. The original ruling came down in April, and it was expanded in June by, you guessed it, a Biden judge. Federal judge blocked Secretary of State Marco Rubio from requiring people to use their actual sex on their passport. Okay, Now that went up to the Court of Appeals. Okay. And the Court of Appeals has sided with that Biden appointed judge. Okay. So at the end of the day, they are taking, these activist judges are taking a position that it's okay to lie on your passport. That's essentially what's going on here. So this activist judge wants to force us to include the gender X as a passport option and allow people to choose whatever sex they feel like on a given day. So you can either choose, you know, say you're a man and you are of, you have this feeling that you are a girl, much like anorexic people have this feeling that they are fat. Transgender people, you know, a man has this feeling, this indescribable feeling that they feel like they're a girl, and the passport, you can allow that man to identify as a female, or somebody can choose X as a gender. Okay, complete and utter insanity. Our judicial system is completely turned into a freaking joke. Okay, so Trump, he knows something obvious, by the way, when he was reelected and retook office, he noticed something obvious for a millennia. A person is almost always born as a male and as a female. Okay, they're either born male or female. And he signed an executive order called Defending Women from Gender Ideology Extremism and Restoring Biological Truth to the Federal Government. And this was signed on his first day back in office, January 20th. Okay, so at the time of the signing, here's what the Trump administration said. Across the country, ideologues who deny biological reality of sex have increasingly used legal and other social coercive means to permit men to self-identify as women and gain access to intimate single-sex spaces and activities designed for women, from women's domestic abuse shelters to women's workplace showers. This is wrong. Efforts to eradicate the biological reality of sex fundamentally attack women by depriving them of their dignity, safety, and well-being. The erasing of sex in language and in policy has a corrosive impact, not just on women, but on the validity of the entire American system. Basing federal policy on truth is crucial to scientific inquiry, public safety, morale, and trust in government itself. Okay, so that's what the Trump administration said at the time when Trump signed this executive order, and this executive order kind of extends to this passport issue. Okay, so really what this needs to do, it needs to move up to the Supreme Court. Okay, this appeals court shut it down, much like the activist Biden appointed judge shut this down, because there are only two sexes, and this is an issue of national security. Okay, you know, I could dream up of hypotheticals all day. You know, you go into an airport, you identify as something different on your passport than what you actually are. An air marshal, somebody, you know, describes a man, you know, on this plane that is acting menacingly and brandished a firearm, you know, on this plane. Okay, now the air marshal, you described a man. He's going to check people's passports. Then the man has F for female. Then he's going to, you know, say, well, it, you know, this is a man and I'm checking this person's, this can't be the person I'm looking for, right? So there is a risk to national security. Not only that, but it's also identifying information. It's for other people's safe or for the individual safety. You know, if you identify as X, how are we going to identify you? If something were to happen, if you were to die, identify your body, right? M or F, like very like basic, like there are two sexes, period. So anything else would constitute as lying on government documentation and an ID. Okay. So we don't want people lying on government documentation. Because that's just going to be a society that descends into chaos. So the judges here, the appeals court judges, they wrote that including actual facts on your passport was not a necessity. Okay, so including the fact of you either being a boy or girl, male or female, that's not a necessity. It is a necessity, okay? We have to have these identifying pieces in government documentation for national security purposes, for your own purposes, okay, if we need to identify you. So in order, the three-judge panel of the first U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals wrote that the Trump administration had failed to argue that the policy does not violate federal law and that the government would be irreparably injured if the policy were enjoined. The administration, the judges wrote, had also failed to engage in meaningfully with an earlier district court analysis that its passport policy is rooted in unconstitutional bias toward transgender Americans, okay? Like an unconstitutional bias towards transgender Americans, that a lower court had said that, and they said that the Trump administration failed to address that or failed to meaningfully engage in that bit from a lower district judge. This is not biased towards anybody. I mean, male, female, it's scientific. I mean, I don't know. Science isn't biased, right? When basic facts of life are questioned by the Democrats and the increasingly activist courts, one has to wonder if too many people have completely lost their minds in this woke era. We've got activist courts, activist judges questioning basic facts of life now, male, female. Okay. It was one thing to have the Democrats do it and to have Democrat politicians do it and kind of grandstand. It's a whole nother thing to have activist courts do it. And, you know, asking you to tell the truth on your passport application should not be a stretch. It is not unconstitutionally biased towards transgender Americans. And they say that this violates the Court of Appeals. They say that the Trump administration failed to argue the policy does not violate federal law and that the government would be irreparably injured if the policy were enjoined. So they wanted the Trump administration to kind of come up with these hypotheticals of how this would injure the government. And I mean, yeah, it would injure the government. It would injure everybody. Okay. If this Trump administration policy isn't enacted, it would injure, you know, not only the person who's lying on their passport potentially, but it would also be a risk of national security. We have to have these identifying documentation be accurate and factual. All right, folks, that's going to be it for us today. Smash that like button, share this out with your friends, subscribe to the channel. We will be back bright and early tomorrow morning, 6 a.m. to 8 a.m. Central Time. Be sure to buy your bottle of Patriot Pump today. And that supports the program. By using promo code ConservativeCat, you can get $10 off your premium pre-workout. It's a pre-workout, fruit punch flavor. It's an alternative to those energy drinks that are full of sugar and caffeine. They try to get you addicted. There's no reason why you should have 300 milligrams of caffeine a day. That's just excessive. And it does more harm than good. I would say, you know, pairing it with black pepper extract, the caffeine, which is what we do in the premium pre-workout formula, Patriot Pump Energy, that is going to provide you long-lasting, effective energy. And I swear by it. I think that it's great stuff. Drink it all the time. Smash that like button. I'll see you guys tomorrow. Bye-bye. Love you so much.